Hello and welcome to the This Month in Forensics podcast for November 2020. I'm Phil Moore and here's a few things from the last month that I wanted to talk about. Of course, this isn't everything. The industry puts out a massive amount of content every week, so for everything that I can find, you can head over to thisweekinforensics.com. A bit of a short one this month. I have been increasingly running out of time. But that's okay, still wanted to get it out, even though it's a few days late. Sorry about that. What do I have to talk about? I did, in the last month, been studying for my Forensics 498 exam, so that's been taking up a bit of my time. If anyone hasn't done that class and wants to get into the ins and outs of acquisition, I highly recommend it. And I was also able to play with the new data set for the ICS Grid Net Wars. About 2 weeks ago, one of my colleagues and his former coworker and I, we put together a little team and we worked through that ICS Grid Net Wars as part of the ICS Summit in Asia, which was really, really cool because I've never really had a chance to work on ICS related activity. And they did a really interesting thing because they kind of led you through what would be a compromise. And it starts with a compromise of a couple of computers or a few computers, followed by lateral movement into a network, pivoting across, and then using the information at hand to try and identify what had happened to the actual ICS systems, the controllers and whatnot, which are obviously not, you know, standard computers. They're not Windows-based workstations necessarily. And so I got to play with some packet captures and read some manuals and try to figure out things that I'm sure people that work in the ICS space do all the time. And we did really well. We were one question short of a perfect score, which sounds really good, but there was like 8 or 9 people that got perfect scores. But, you know, I was pretty proud of the way we went. So definitely something to check out. And enough about me and on to a few of the things that I thought I wanted to quickly mention. And then I'm probably going to head to bed. Kurtar Ozer wrote a really interesting and comprehensive post about the user assist Windows Forensic Artifact. He tested Windows 10, one of the newer builds of Windows 10. But it's entirely possible that some of these observations actually do go back to earlier versions of Windows 10. And what he was finding was that there were entries within User Assist that were being recorded with a last, well, that had seemingly been last executed when in fact they hadn't. And the reason that I say seemingly been last executed is because the common understanding is that an item within the user assist key is an item that is a UI program that has been executed. And what this testing showed is that that's not necessarily the case in all instances. So in one of the tests that was performed, if a user opened the start menu and then navigated to the path of the shortcut by right-clicking the app icon and then going open file location, then a new entry will be added into one of the user assist keys, the one that starts in CEB. And then as a result, the last execution time is populated and a run count was appended. I think from memory, it said the run count is actually incremented. So, you know, does that mean that a program was executed the same number of times as it says in the last execution time? It's now, you know, a little bit less accurate because it could have been executed that many times, but it might have been executed less. Now, there are a few things to consider here. One being, if a user has right-clicked and gone to the file location, you'll likely get a shell bag entry updated, and that might give you some context around the user navigating to that directory. They may execute the program after that, and then it might update a different user assist artifact as well. There would be other evidence of execution when that program is run compared to when that program is just, you know, navigated to. And you can correlate a lot of that information together because, you know, when you've got a user assist key update, you might also have a prefetch file or an AMP cache entry or any other number of program execution artifacts that help to corroborate the story that you're telling. And the other thing that Kotar looked into was when an item has a run count of zero, and I am going to have to scroll down and try and remember what he found from that. I do recall a long time ago, Matt Sayer did some research into this, this was referenced in Kotar's post as well, along with the testing that Dave Cowan did on his Forensic Lunch series. So I think from just skimming this again, that he wasn't exactly able to tell why some of these items had a run count of zero and no dates. Some of them do have dates, some of them don't. Matt came to some conclusions, and really I should have done a bit more preparation, but what I would suggest definitely is to go back and read some of these articles and to try and see what we can figure out, you know, whether the conclusions have been drawn or whether you can replicate the information that's been identified. And I'm going to move on to the next one, which I've mentioned the DFI report before, and I feel like it's worth mentioning them again. They published three articles this last month, one related to Ryuk, another was crypto miners exploiting WebLogic RCE, and the last one is a ransomware deployment of the PYSA Mespinosa ransomware. And the reason why I'm going to point them out is not because I want to talk about anything specifically about these, more that they just put a very comprehensive, it's a very comprehensive report together, article together, explaining how the attacks have unfolded, giving quite good detail about what has happened. And if you subscribe to the Patreon, you get artifacts and IOCs and other fun things. But I just think that from a technical standpoint, they do a great job of presenting the information that they've obtained. Now, would this be a report you want to give to a client? Maybe, maybe not. But I think that these reports are fantastic for learning to see how attackers are acting. And maybe if you run your own environments, you could kind of, you know, play along and see maybe, could you detect this activity? Could you respond to this activity? Alexander Jaeger at Open Source DFIR, which is run by a bunch of folks at Google, has written an interesting post about how they've just implemented Sigma into TimeSketch. The only reason I'm mentioning this is because there are two things that I really want to, you know, dig into a little bit, if I can afford the time. I briefly played with TimeSketch last year, and I found it really interesting. It can be quite useful if you really spend the time to learn how to use it and use it well. And then on top of that, Sigma being the, you know, Yara for Seam signature format, I think being able to incorporate things like that into a timelining tool, which really TimeSketch is just a UI for logged timeline at Plazo, then if you can use that as a kind of quick win, then I think it's worth exploring. So it's on my to-do list to look into, to spend a bit of time on, and hopefully I'll be able to do that soon. So I'm grateful for this post. I'm grateful for them to have incorporated that. On the Sketchy Moose blog, there was a great post about the Windows subsystem for Linux. Now, very few people have done forensics work into WSL. A lot of people use WSL, but I haven't seen a huge amount of the forensic side of things. And that's likely because, hey, it's Linux, you know, it's not that interesting. From a Windows forensic standpoint, I should rephrase that. It's not that it's not interesting. It's more that the artifacts that you would expect to see in WSL are likely the same as what you would expect to see in a Linux investigation. And therefore, that is where you'd be looking. The Windows artifacts would be on the Windows side, and we know those, and then the Linux, we know those. But WSL being the fact that it's an emulated version or a virtual version of Linux on Windows, it can act a little bit differently. So what was written about on this post was how you can do certain things like launching a command through PowerShell, like invoking WSL from PowerShell and then running a command, and what that might look like. What does the process activity look like? What does the file activity look like? What network, all this fun stuff. And it's quite an interesting post where you can go and see what you might see if someone has been using WSL. Do people use it to do bad things? I'm not sure, maybe. I guess that I'd be interested to hear if people have found attackers using WSL when they get onto an endpoint, maybe potentially to even hide their activity. Because if an examiner is not looking for WSL activity and they're expecting all the Windows artifacts to cover all the things that were being misused, then they will likely miss things. So yeah, well worth the read there. I included this article by Brett at DFIR.training mainly because it mentions me, and mainly I guess I kind of want to not exactly respond to it, I guess comment on it. And so what Brett has written about here is the fact that there are lots of how do I get into DFIR questions. They get asked a lot, and his commentary was really that there isn't a roadmap. There's no path. There's no do these five things and you will get into DFIR. There are people that come off the street, off a patrol. They get given a computer and say, here you go. You're our new digital forensic examiner. And they set up a lab in a closet and eventually end up, you know, living the life and doing everything that they found that they love to do. And there are other people that said from the beginning, you know, this is what I'm interested in, this is what I want to do, and they made it happen. Now, how do you make it happen? Any number of which ways, which is what the point of Brett's post is. So what he talks about is that you can use what he describes as the five E's, education, experience, educating, extra, end, where you can try and identify what your end goal is, and then work backwards to try and say, well, what do I need to go to those, to get into that role? What type of education do I need? Do I need a formal degree? And maybe that might be something that your aspirational job requires. So when I started in law enforcement as a civilian, I had to have a degree. Now, fortunately for me, by the time I decided I wanted to go into digital forensics, I already had almost finished that degree. So, you know, that kind of ticked that box. But there are people that were very suitable that had, you know, X years of experience in IT that were saying, I really want to do digital forensics in law enforcement, that we couldn't hire. And it was just unfortunately because that was a degree requirement of that organization. Whether people believe that's the right course of action or not, kind of up for debate. But, you know, sometimes these are just requirements that people, that jobs have, and there's no way around it. Similarly, Brett talks about, you know, experience, getting experience, how you might go about getting experience, whether that means self-teaching, which document your research, experimentation, reading things, trying to get internships, you know, obviously getting employment. One of the things I really wanted to mention with regards to that experience and that self-taught, and it leads on to the next part, which is education, is that, you know, that this is a field where it really comes down to your willingness to learn, your willingness to break things. There is a lot of very good free research and testing and documentation and training that you can use. And, you know, I say this working for a training provider, what we do, you know, at SANS is really, really, really good at packaging a lot of things that you could, in some instances, in some of the classes, you could teach yourself. And that takes some people a lot of effort. And you know, what we do at Sands is we try to make it the best quality product that you can have. And you obviously should try and supplement that as much as you can with self-teaching and all that stuff. Now, the reason why I'm bringing that up is because the people that are very, very, very brand new, that are just having an interest, they cannot afford to pay for training necessarily out of their own pocket. And, you know, that's a completely different conversation. But dropping $7,000 for a training class for a field you might be interested in is kind of out of the question for a lot of people. And so that's why, you know, educating yourself and testing and reading and stuff is a really, really good way of helping you on your path into, you know, that final end goal. Now, one of the things that Brett mentions in this post was, you know, one of the tweets that I had a while back, which was, does anyone have a good system for tracking training classes and learning directives and putting them into a skills matrix? Now, I probably misphrased the question for what I wanted. I overly broadened it to try and see if I could get a response that, you know, linked into what I wanted, which everyone focused in on that skills matrix part and pointed me to the NICE framework, which I'm sure is quite suitable to what people want to use it for, but it wasn't something that I wanted to use for my goals. What I want and what I've been trying to find is a way that I can record all of the available training classes that I could take, excluding university because it's kind of outside the scope of my interest at the moment, and then allow me to, you know, hit star and say, okay, these are the 100, 200 classes that are available. Well, am I interested in all of these classes? And then from there, you know, decide on not exactly a pathway, but, you know, which one should I strive to go after next? And it might be, I might have to do these four training classes before I even get to that fifth one that I do want to do. So for example, I know I don't know a lot about network forensics, but I think that going and taking an intense network forensics class with my current knowledge is probably not as well received as if I had taken some of the introductory classes first, which I may know part of, but for me, that's just how I work. And so, you know, I would hope, and I do hope that DFIT.training and Brett come through with kind of the thing that I'm after, which is, you know, a big repository of training classes that I can just start. And I can say, I want to take these classes. And then, you know, that might be 50 classes that I can easily go through and say, all right, which are the ones that I want to take next? Now, granted, if you're only taking one class a year, 50 classes is going to take you a little bit of time to get through. But there are a lot of great classes that I mean to do that might only be, you know, even a few hours in some instance, like the class by basis on investigative theory. I talked about it last month and I can't remember the name of it. But by all accounts, it's a very good class and it's only a few hours. You know, the autopsy class, I've got that saved to do. I just need to make the time to do it. And so then the next question is, you know, how do you plan that over a period? Now, that does lead into the skills matrix, because there are people that want to use the NICE framework and a skills matrix to say, all right, cool, I've got all of this. That means I can, you know, ask for a promotion, or now I am considered a senior because I've now got this degree of training and expertise in a field, and that's fine. For me, I'm more interested in learning things that and filling gaps rather in my knowledge than moving up, but I appreciate that my requirements are very different from you know, anyone else's requirements. Maybe they're not, but, you know, I know what my requirements are for, and I'm being selfish and asking for something for me in the hopes that someone has a solution. What was next? Dark Defender has written a great post about checking if your computer has been hacked. It's not, I wouldn't say, you know, the most groundbreaking, you know, these are the hidden places that the hackers will hide and you'll never find them unless you look in these specific places. What the post covers is, you know, some of the very common artifacts that you might want to look at, and that is that will help you identify suspicious activity. Things like 4624 events in your event logs, or a series of failed logons, or a new account being created. OAlerts, for example, or checking your internet history. They walk through a few of the ins and outs of all of these different artifacts, as well as, you know, things like common persistence mechanisms that you might find creepy crawlies hiding in. And so I like this post. I think it's just because it's things that people may already know doesn't mean it's things that people shouldn't get a refresher on. So I think it was good to read. Good to read. What else do we have? Only a few more things to talk about because I've been rambling for a little while now. Amy Nguyen at Samuri has written a post about the recent changes with the Big Sur and I think the M1 MacBooks. Let me just double check. So the significant changes that come with Big Sur and the Apple M1 chipset, which is all the rage in the Apple community at the moment. Apparently it's very good. Apparently there are also some issues when it comes to a new Apple system and forensics. Who knew? It's only been always like that. I shouldn't be so sarcastic. So unfortunately, what has been identified in this post, and I guess what they want to bring to our attention, is that at the moment, and maybe in the future, we actually won't be able to boot our M1 chipset Macs into an alternate version of macOS. So third-party bootable images are currently, and maybe for future, not working. Apple also removed target disk mode. They replaced it with sharing mode. I'm not sure what sharing mode is. Then on top of that, FileVault encouraged being on, which they've been doing for a long time. They've made a lot of strides to improving security on, you know, new Macs. And that means that our Samuri Recon or Black Bag Macquisition, or what it's called now, a Cellbrite Data Collector, may be limited if we don't have any access to a user's password, which kind of was already the case, but we couldn't even brute force it because we can't get an image. And that's kind of just going to be the nature as security improves. That's that cat and mouse game as vendors start to try and pop up and help bypass security controls, and then Apple fixes them, etc., etc. That's just the nature of the game. The last couple, the OSDFCon videos, I mentioned Basis Technology a little bit ago, but the recent OSDF conference was run, and they have uploaded all the videos from the presentations from the day onto YouTube, which I've got to go back and watch a couple of them still. There was a few that stood out. I need to watch Brian's talk on RDP, recovering RDP bitmaps, because I know he's done a lot of really good research and he's just been improving that. Sarah Edwards has always got good talks to talk about Apollo. I wanted to watch a few of the other ones, but I'm not going to list them all out here, but I'll link to the video in the show notes. And then the last thing to talk about is for anyone that doesn't actually know about Kostas K goes by Kakos, K-A-C-O-S, 2000 on GitHub. He has been doing, historically he's done quite a lot of really, really good research, and it's kind of hidden away on this GitHub. So I highly recommend people go and have a look at it. And it kind of slowly puts together things as he finds them and loads it up here, and you can go and read up about how he's tested and discovered and written scripts to parse a whole bunch of different artifacts on Windows 10, which is great. And what he has done just recently, I think in the last week actually, was release the Windows 10 Live Information Viewer. And not something I've played with, full disclosure there, but just looking at the image and having spoken to Kostas quite a bit, plus used some of the tools that he's produced, I think it's really cool, especially for testing, to be able to run a lot of this stuff, which I think just uses PowerShell in the background, to process a lot of information on a live system. Now, it might not be something you use in an investigation. It might be, just depends. I think for testing, some of this stuff is really, really, really cool, because you can just click a button and say, I want to see how my recent action affected the plug and play devices, or what have I got here, the scheduled tasks, or any cloud storage apps that are running, which again, you might, maybe you do want to run that on a live system to triage it. It's on my list of things to play with, and I think other people should play with it as well, and go and give Kostas your feedback, because that is how we all improve. I think that I have rambled for plenty of time now, and that is all of the things that I wanted to mention this month. Of course, as I said, that isn't everything. For everything that I have found, you can head over to thisweekinforensics.com. For those loyal patrons through Patreon, thank you, thank you, thank you again. For those that aren't on the Patreon, that it's not a problem. It's not something I'm holding against anyone. If you get a bit of value out of my work throughout the months and the years, and you want to give a little bit of value back, the link is just patreon.com/thisweekinforensics. It's at the top of the pages. It's all over the website. And I very, very much appreciate any dollars thrown at me. Dollars or paper. Dollar coins or paper notes or digitally. It's all appreciated. For those that are Patreon supporters, you will get the links that I have mentioned, as well as the time codes for when I've mentioned them. And if you want a sticker, shoot me a message through the Patreon app and I will send you a sticker. Somehow I will get it to you. And thanks a lot to everyone that has donated. It is very, very much appreciated. If you have got any suggestions or recommendations, you can let me know on Twitter. I am at Phil Moore. Special thanks to my friend Jeff, who is Animatic on SoundCloud, for letting me use his tracks. Thank you for listening, and I will speak to you next month.